Oh, excuse me for a minute while I step inside the control room. Ah, that's better. Now, please be patient a few more seconds while we pay the bills.
Did you say Hairmaster?
No, you dimwit. Airmaster.
Caremaster?
No, Airmaster.
Daremaster?
Clean your ears out. I said Airmaster.
Stairmaster?
Oops, don't try that one. It's probably trademarked by someone else. Airmaster.
Ha ha, got you on that one. I said Stairmaster. S-T-A-R-E, Master. Tearmaster?
I'm going to tear you. Airmaster!
Oh, I get it. Airmaster.
Yes, Airmaster.
But what do they do?
Airmaster Aerator, the patented aerator that makes a difference. More than an aerator, a complete waste treatment system. Airmaster Aerator.
The following column was written by Jim Thompson. I'm Chuck Swan, reading it for Jim. Jim's title for this column is The Environment and Regulations. And here's what Jim Thompson has to say about the environment and regulations. In the years since we started using monthly editorial themes, this is Environment and Regulations Month, if you have not figured it out by now, these subjects, the environment and regulations, have become more and more politicized and less, it seems to me, based on solid science and facts. A story I was told several years ago, and I can't even verify if it is fact, illustrates the point and went like this. A certain politician, when asked about the pH in the effluent from a certain mill, clenched his fist and said, "You can be certain I will get legislation passed that drives pH to zero. We will not tolerate pH any longer." Well, I want to see the facility that has a discharge of 0.0 pH, and I think most of our readers here would like to see it too. Have regulations in some cases become too onerous? Certainly the answer is yes. In other areas, we can all agree they are too loose. Here is an example from the medical area. Just yesterday, I got a 4-page, obviously computer-generated letter from my insurance company concerning something that happened around the 4th of March this year. The letter droned on and on about how it was sent to me in compliance with such and such regulations and the procedure I should follow if I disagree with the insurance company's decision. What it failed to say was that the procedure was who ordered it, what the insurance company's decision was, or anything else that would give me a clue as to why they sent it to me. This is where we see the cost of regulations that are sometimes discussed in the news. A certain state where we used to have employees, but do not have any now, sends me a dunning letter about 85 days after the end of each quarter, saying if I don't pay my withheld employment taxes, they're going to place a lien against our property, blah, blah, blah. It has become routine. So I go into their state website, fill out a form, and swear we had no employees for the subject quarter. I have done this for 2 years. All the previous electronic filings I have done show zero liability, and no one has questioned that. Yet there is no place in their system where I can tell them once and for all we have no employees in that state. So each quarter I go through this exercise. Environmental issues are even worse. Everyone is an expert. If you counter anyone's comments with comments of your own, you are labeled an uncaring idiot, or worse. I have lived through paper bags are bad, use plastic, and now plastic bags are bad, use paper. That's just one little example. We have absolutely no trusted clearinghouse worldwide on environmental issues that everyone can look to with assurance of correct answers. And I'll bet I will get some emails even criticizing this statement. So what is an enterprise that recognizes that its main objective is to spin the invoice printer in a socially responsible way to do? Sadly, I think you will need to expand your bureaucracy a bit. Corporations need a department staffed with smart and honest professionals that serves as a clearinghouse for all regulations and environmental positions. It will take some appropriate scientists, accountants, lawyers, and public relations professionals. This department will need a leader with the capabilities to direct a team charged with putting humankind on Mars. It just may be the most important non-operational position in the company. But this is what the world is coming to, folks. If we're going to spin the invoice printer at its optimum and retain as much profit as possible, we must find a way to get the environmental and regulations game under control. For safety this week, we need first to understand and follow all safety regulations. But we need to go further than this. We need to make sure we do all the practical things necessary to keep our people safe, no matter what the regulations say. We owe this to our employees and their families. Be safe, and we will talk next week. Nip Impressions is written by Jim Thompson and is copyright 2019, Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, USA. All rights reserved.
Oh, excuse me for a minute while I step inside the control room. Ah, that's better. Now, please be patient a few more seconds while we pay the bills.
Are you facing a complex installation, expansion, greenfield project, or maintenance project? Make the smart choice. C.R. Meyer, a nationwide industrial general contractor, specializes in the pulp and paper industry. Our skilled millwrights, pipe fitters, iron workers, boiler makers, carpenters, laborers, cement finishers, operators, and a team of experienced project managers, architects, and engineers are safe, effective, and efficient on any project, planned or unplanned. Take the smart step toward getting your next project finished safely and done well. Contact C.R. Meyer at crmeyer.com.
The following column was written by Jim Thompson. I'm Chuck Swan, reading it for Jim. Jim's column is entitled, Thoughts on the Environmental Dialogue. And here's what Jim has to say about that. I was asked the other day where I thought our audience's opinion was on the question of global warming, climate change, and so forth. My unscientific response is that I believe that about 90% of our audience remains somewhat skeptical, down from 100% just a few years ago. I remain skeptical for several reasons. First, when people call me a climate denier, all that does for me is tell me they have got nothing else. Thinking you are denigrating a person merely shows how small you are. You either don't understand the science yourself, or you haven't spent the effort to understand it. Going along with the crowd proves nothing. Crowd thinking has been proven wrong time and time again on many different subjects down through history. Just ask Galileo. Let me assure you, I want clean air, clean water, and a stable environment as much as the next person. In my lifetime, I have seen unbelievably positive strides taken to get us there. The question is, what is left to do, and what is the cost, measured by any metric, to accomplish what is left to do? By the way, all comments are welcome here, as long as they're not just nasty name-calling. Although I have never been there, Wikipedia reports that Ohio Stadium in Columbus, Ohio, as of 2014, had 104,944 seats, but that a renovation started in 2017 to add more luxury suites will eventually reduce this capacity by 2,600 seats. For our purpose here today, with the permission of the reader, let's just round this off to 100,000 seats. I read recently that if one visualizes a stadium as the one we just have done so above at 100,000 seats, one can begin to understand the makeup of our atmosphere. If we assign one seat for each molecule of gas in the atmosphere, goes this reasoning, and I have enhanced it here, 78,000 seats will be occupied by nitrogen. Another 21,000 seats will be occupied by oxygen, and the balance, the other 1,000 seats, will be occupied by all the other components in the atmosphere. In other words, fewer seats than they're lopping off so the fat cats can enjoy their favorite sport in conditioned comfort. Carbon dioxide, a necessary component in the cycle of life, animals exhale it, plants inhale it, has been as high as 4,000 parts per million during the Cambrian period, about 500 million years ago, to as low as 180 parts per million during the Quaternary glaciation of the past 2 million years. The concentration of carbon dioxide since the mid-18th century, that is, since the time of the American Revolution, has increased to a level of 410 parts per million today. The source? You guessed it, Wikipedia. Going back to OSU for a moment, this says that during the Cambrian period, carbon dioxide would have occupied 400 seats during the Quaternary glaciation. This would have dramatically dropped to 18 seats, and today it would still be only 41 seats in our stadium model. Now, there are those who find today's number shocking, and further, often these same people want us to believe that today's 41 seats out of 100,000 is a disaster. To further pile onto the worry and guilt they want to place on your poor head, they must make the arguments that, A, this much carbon dioxide will lead to a catastrophe on Earth, and that, B, the cause of the rise from 18 seats to 41 seats has an anthropogenic, that is, humankind, origin. Perhaps a visit to a tomato-raising greenhouse would be in order here. Do you know that such greenhouses often inject additional carbon dioxide into their atmosphere to enhance plant growth? It is well known that additional carbon dioxide has a very positive effect on plant growth. NASA reported on April 26, 2016, quote, from a quarter to half of Earth's vegetated lands has shown significant greening over the last 35 years, largely due to rising levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide, according to a new study published in the journal Nature Climate Change on April 25th, end of quote. This effect has even reached the Sahara Desert, as reported in the Santa Barbara Independent, January 10th, 2019. Among other factors credited for the greening of the Sahara Desert, the article states that rising carbon levels in the atmosphere provide a kind of aerial fertilization that increases plant growth while utilizing water more efficiently. The more carbon dioxide there is in the air, the more plants grow. End of quote. Even though the rise to 41 seats from 18 seats seems to have some positive effects, naysayers still want to blame this rise, as if it is a problem, on humankind, and in particular on the rise in human population, as well as the activities of humans. Folks, the Earth is still relatively unpopulated by humans. As I have stated in the past, every human being on Earth, if placed in Jacksonville, Florida, will each have a square approximately 22 inches on a side in which to stand. Although we would not want to leave them standing there for long, this visualization demonstrates how truly sparsely populated the Earth really is. Now, can we agree that 200-pound human beings likely inhale as much oxygen and exhale as much carbon dioxide as one 200-pound human being? After all, the needs of bodies at the cellular level is nearly constant. So whether those cells are in one body or two, the aggregate needs for oxygen and the exhalation of carbon dioxide will be nearly the same. How about insects? Would 200 pounds of insects inhale roughly as much oxygen and exhale as much carbon dioxide as the same weight of larger animals? Seems reasonable, doesn't it? Well, several sources tell us the weight of all the humans on the Earth is approximately 316 million tons. The venerable Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail, reported on February 21, 2018, that the weight of all insects in the world, not including spiders, classified as arachnids, not insects, is about 70 times the weight of the human population, or 22,120 million tons. Back to the stadium. If we break the world into just humans and insects, ignoring spiders, cows, horses, and all the other animals, and assume all carbon dioxide is the result of exhalation from living species, the human-caused carbon dioxide occupies just over one-half of 1%, and the insect-caused carbon dioxide occupies the other 40.5 seats. Did I mention that thus far the insects have been impervious to our pleas for them to lighten up on their exhalations? Perhaps it's time to get out the DDT. That's a joke. Don't get out the DDT. For safety this week, we can surely agree on one thing. Humans need oxygen. How many lives have been lost in pulp and paper mills in the last decade or so due to ineffective sniffing of confined spaces? I can think of about a dozen. Review your confined space entry procedures. Be safe, and we will talk next week. Nip Impressions is written by Jim Thompson and is copyright 2019, Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, USA. All rights reserved.
Oh, excuse me for a minute while I step inside the control room. Ah, that's better. Now, please be patient a few more seconds while we pay the bills.
Companies all over North America think of Fulton Systems for their thermocompressor and steam systems needs, all the way from initial design to startup to troubleshooting. For more than 90 years, Fulton Systems has helped companies keep thousands of thermocompressors operating smoothly and assisted mills with hundreds of paper machine rebuilds. Turn to Fulton Systems for steam and condensate system design, dryer suction performance audits, and consulting services on all aspects of dryer suction and condensate systems management and operations. Call us at 770-447-1400. Visit our website at fultonsystems.com. The following column was written by Jim Thompson. I'm Chuck Swan, reading it for Jim. The title of Jim's column this week is Remember This About Regulators. Here's what Jim Thompson has to say about that. We can all agree that a certain amount of regulation is necessary. This is what makes modern society function as efficiently as it does. Certainly, it can function more efficiently, but that is a topic for another day. In business, we often see regulations as purely a cost, and in some cases, they may be. Another way of looking at this, though, is that those very regulations, applied equitably across the board, just may be protecting you from a competitor or a supplier who, left to their own devices, might cause extra costs to your business or cause you not to be competitive. However, today I want to take this topic down a different path. Let's think for a little bit about regulators, the humans that we have to deal with regularly. Yes, once we cover the caveats I listed above, we see them as a cost. That is not how they may see the matter, though. There are many regulators who view their jobs with a passion, often found in the environmental or employee safety areas. Their passions may have started at a young age. Perhaps they had a parent who was injured at work when he or she was a child and grew up resolved to make sure that it did not happen to anyone else. Perhaps they had a relative that died of some hideous disease attributed to a workplace environment. Or in school, they became passionate about the environment and are determined to do something about it in their careers. And of course, on top of this deep-seated passion, they earn their livings as regulators. Treat such persons as a nuisance, a cost, and with contempt, at your peril. All you are doing is reinforcing their preconceived negative notions of businesses, particularly manufacturing businesses. It goes without saying, like everyone else who comes on your property, they need to be treated professionally and with respect. This does not mean you should open your books and data to them any more than you would to any supplier. But on the other hand, do not be overly protective nor suspicious. A mistreated regulator can find ways to cost your company money beyond what is necessary to maintain a legal, moral, and ethical business. In some cases, they have criminal prosecution powers or can call in those who do. Site managers really don't like it when such an egregious environmental situation exists that their freedom is in peril. Another condition to watch for is that which occurs when you arrive on a site as the new general manager. If your predecessor had been cheating on reporting requirements, you can be in trouble. While not the overall site manager, I once arrived on a site in charge of the environmental conditions as part of my overall responsibilities. We had a certain condition which we were supposed to report to the state regulatory authority within 24 hours if we had an excursion outside our limits. The folks on site who reported to me asked what they were to do if we had such an excursion. My answer,
Reported, of course. Well, in my first few months, we had a number of out-of-limits conditions, and we duly reported them. Regulators and our own corporate management ask what is going on. There's not been a reported out-of-limit condition at your mill in several years. The answer was simple once I investigated it. My predecessor had not reported the problems. Fortunately, I had already established a good relationship with the regulators and our in-house counsel involved in these matters. We were able to make corrections to our process and stay out of serious trouble. However, if I had started out with an adversarial attitude, things could have become much, much worse for me and my manager. For safety this week, environmental and safety regulations protect us as employees, too. Let's not forget this as we go about our daily tasks. Be safe, and we will talk next week. Nip Impressions is written by Jim Thompson and is copyright 2019, Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, USA. All rights reserved.
Oh, excuse me for a minute while I step inside the control room. Ah, that's better. Now, please be patient a few more seconds while we pay the bills.
From bales to cores to finished rolls and parent rolls, automatic handling is your guide to overcoming the worst material handling headaches. Located in Erie, Michigan, Automatic Handling International has been providing advanced state-of-the-art equipment to the paper industry for over four decades. Automatic Handling's equipment makes management, operators, and maintenance smile. Elegant solutions, simple to operate and maintain. You get a feel for their dedication to advanced equipment design and advanced manufacturing when you visit their factory. Vertically integrated, the company can control every stage of a capital project from design and manufacture to full in-house runoffs and mill startups. You won't find a paper drawing anywhere in their plant. All manufacturing and assembly is directly linked to engineering and select suppliers. The assembly floor is instantly updated on any changes with extraordinarily large screens where technicians can see every piece, every assembly detail in 3D. This means your equipment can be custom designed and built for your operations while still providing extremely short lead times for your new solution from Automatic Handling. That's Automatic Handling International Incorporated, Erie, Michigan, USA. Visit them at www.automatichandling.com or call them at 734-847-0633. That's 734-847-0633.
The following column was written by Jim Thompson. I'm Chuck Swan, reading it for Jim. Jim's title for this week's column is Other Regulatory Impacts. And here's what Jim has to say about that. When we think of regulatory enforcers, we often think of professionally dressed folks showing up at the front entrance of our facility with briefcases full of forms. Or perhaps we're thinking of Wall Street regulators making sure there is no insider trading or those sorts of matters. Other regulators abound all around us. Many are on the payroll of our employer. For instance, the Internal Audit Department assures us that all assets are present and properly accounted. Try to take out something as small as a pump, and they may show up to ask you what is going on. There may be a discussion as to whether that pump is fully amortized or depreciated.
Likewise, when you are told to report all injuries, no matter how small, this is your safety team at work, assuring the company that all safety hazards are minimized. Foolishly, when I was very young in the industry, I thought this was silly, and only a wimp would report the use of a Band-Aid. Comes from growing up on a farm where cuts and scrapes were the order of the day. The IT folks have gotten into being regulators too. Many companies have policies concerning USB drives, access to videos, and other such foreign penetrations of their intranet systems. It is prudent and necessary in today's world to protect those most valuable of assets. One time I tried to move certain parts of my employer's manufacturing jobs to a prison system in a state that actively promoted such business. I was slapped down by our human resources department. They saw a bigger picture than I did at that time. That was regulatory. Companies have always been concerned about antitrust, theft of trade secrets, and so forth. This has led to a process in recent years that is somewhat onerous. In some companies now, in order to go to a conference or a trade show, two interviews with in-house lawyers are required. The first interview asks questions such as, why you are going, what are you going to do, who will you see? This interview may also include an admonition to stay away from hospitality suites. The second interview is upon one's return from an approved conference. In this case, same questions all over again, making sure you have followed the rules, and if you did take a side excursion, what was it, who did you see, and why did you do it? It goes without saying, this last bit of internal regulation is stifling conference attendance. For safety this week, again, regulations are important, especially placarded safety regulations found throughout your mill and on transportation equipment. Heed and follow all such regulations. Be safe, and we will talk next week. Nip Impressions is written by Jim Thompson and is copyright 2019, Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, USA. All rights reserved.
Oh, excuse me for a minute while I step inside the control room. Ah, that's better. Now, please be patient a few more seconds while we pay the bills.
Well, it's time to start planning our annual recovery boiler outage again.
Yes, it is. Budgets are tighter than ever, even though business is good. And speaking of good business, sales is pressuring us to have as short an outage as possible. They need the production.
Well, getting in a hurry costs money and can lead to safety problems.
I know. And you know we are always under pressure for our safety record, too. It seems like corporate has nothing better to do than to keep pushing us on every front.
I think I have a solution to all of these problems.
What's that?
RMR Mechanical. They've done a great work for us in the past and have a great safety record, too. They almost always beat the schedule.
Sounds like this meeting is over.
RMR Mechanical. The only name you need to know for an economical, quick, and safe boiler outage. Phone 770-205-9646 or visit us on the web at rmrmechanical.com. The following column was created by Jim Thompson. Jim's title for this column is Rebuttal to Column of 8 July 2019, Thoughts on the Environmental Dialogue. I'm Chuck Swan reading the column for Jim, and here's what Jim has to say. My column of 8 July 2019 elicited a number of comments from readers. At the time, our feedback form at the bottom of each column was not working. It is now, thanks to these fine folks bringing this to our attention, and they wanted to be able to make their voices heard. This is an appropriate idea, so I wrote to them as a group on 11 July with the following message. You are receiving this email because you and others expressed an opposing view to Jim Thompson's Nip Impressions column of 8 July, Thoughts on the Environmental Dialogue. We want to let you be heard. We will publish all the rebuttals we get as one column dated week of 29 July, provided you follow these ground rules. 1. You must be willing to let us print your name and email address. We will verify these with you before you will be included. 2. Your rebuttal must be A. Not be political, B. Not use foul language, or be derogatory towards any person, political office, institution, or organization. C. Not include citations such as 97% of all scientists say, or cite any United Nations organization or works. D. Not be an advertisement or an endorsement for services or products you sell or represent. E. Be in simple enough terms that a fifth or sixth grader can understand it. 3. All submittals become the property of Paparitalo Publications, LLC. Due to our publishing schedule, we will need your work no later than the end of the business day, 19 July. If it is close but not within our guidelines, we will work with you. If it is simply a rant, we won't, and you won't be published. Thank you for your interest in Nip Impressions. I thought this was fair, and these are generally the rules I follow when writing Nip Impressions. Only 2 of the people who received these ground rules chose to respond in a timely fashion and stayed generally within them. Another veered far from them, fought with me over them, and is not included. But before we get to their responses, I thought I would share an interesting article that I was pointed to by my daughter, a noted renewable energy engineer and scientist who works for the U.S. government and with whom I often disagree. It is along the lines of some parts of my 8 July 19 article, but she did not share it until after the 8 July 19. You can find the somewhat lengthy website address of this article in the printed version of this column in Nip Impressions. Then there are 2 sites that I consult regularly on the issue of climate change. I am sure our respondents will disagree with their veracity and their funding. However, in the interest of fairness to all sides, I include them without comment here. I will hasten to say they are considered by some to be political. Again, you can find the website addresses in the printed version of this column in Nip Impressions. It is important to note that I put my comments at the beginning of this column, not the end, for I desire that you, dear reader, leave this column with the words of the rebutters, not mine, fresh in your mind. Now to the rebuttals. This is from John Fitzgerald. Dear Mr. Thompson and Nip Impressions readers, one point of agreement is that name-calling is counterproductive regardless of one's beliefs. Often those who believe in anthropogenic climate change are labeled by those with differing views as environmental extremists or even environmental terrorists. A colleague friend of mine referred to us, I include myself in the believing persuasion, as a bunch of nuts. So if placing a label indicates a weakness in one's position, then those on the other side of the discussion must be subject to the same criticism. If I must use a label for those with doubts, then climate change skeptic would be my preference. Perhaps one of the biggest casualties of global warming is the ability of people to disagree in a civil manner without resorting to name-calling or other verbal insults. I agree with the notion that the consensus opinion is often proven to not be correct. It may ultimately prove that the climate change crisis is either less severe or more severe than the current consensus regards it. You had mentioned how Galileo was ultimately correct in his view of the universe. I might point out that Stephen Hawking, the most brilliant scientist since Einstein or Newton, and one who often promoted iconoclastic ideas, nevertheless regarded anthropogenic climate change as a fact and was very concerned that mankind is not yet seriously addressing it and that we're already very close to the point where it becomes irreversible. In the case of Galileo, his findings were contradicting not scientific research, but religious dogma that stated the Earth was the center of the universe. In this case, those disagreeing with anthropogenic climate change are contradicting the overwhelming consensus of research derived by use of the scientific method. Regarding the stadium analogy, there are a number of concerns with the argument. The stated range of carbon dioxide, that is CO2, from 180 parts per million to 4,000 parts per million over the last 500 years is approximately correct. Of course, as you note, the 180 parts per million represents the level at the peak of an ice age. The average CO2 concentration during the Cambrian period was indeed about 4,000 parts per million. However, at that time, the average temperature was about 7 degrees centigrade higher than the present, and sea level was about 180 feet above the current because of very little, if any, glaciation on the planet. Also, there was only limited, very primitive plant life and no animal life on land, so its relevance to the current situation is not very apparent. Shifting the discussion to respiration of creatures as the primary source of CO2 rise in the atmosphere would appear to be a bit of a red herring. To my knowledge, no serious climate scientist believes either the respiration of people or that of insects, for that matter, has a major impact on CO2 content of the atmosphere. Although it is possible insects, specifically tropical termites, as impacted by human deforestation practices, may have significant impact on methane levels. The release of carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases due to the use of fossil fuels and other human activities such as deforestation, animal husbandry, amongst others, is the overwhelming source of our impact on the atmosphere. We are currently adding more than 9 billion tons of carbon, 33 billion tons of CO2, to the atmosphere each year via fossil fuel burning and cement manufacture. Respiration of 7.5 billion humans is adding about 10% of that amount, about 3.1 billion tons. The net impact of respiration of insects depends on whether their mass is changing or steady over time. Also, one would note that a cold-blooded insect, pound for pound, should produce less CO2 than a warm-blooded human. As carbon dioxide rises, ocean acidification becomes as great an environmental concern as the temperature rise, and that is ignored in this discussion. Ocean acidification in combination with warming water is doing increasing harm to corals, shellfish, and other aspects of marine ecosystems. That many areas of the Earth should be greening as the planet warms should be expected. Other areas should do the converse. This should all be expected as precipitation patterns shift with the warming climate. Many plants should indeed respond favorably to rising CO2 levels, but the question becomes as to whether those deemed by mankind to be beneficial plants or those not so regarded will be preferentially enhanced. For example, poison ivy is particularly nurtured by rising CO2 levels, with its growth rates and potency doubling since the 1960s. Perhaps the most important consideration would be for the principal grain crops. A 2016 NASA study indicates the negative effects due to temperature extremes and water scarcity brought about by global warming are compensated to a significant effect by CO2 improved photosynthetic yields and reduced transpiration. So globally for wheat and soybeans, there is no projected net impact, better or worse, a slight net negative for rice, but a still significant net negative impact for corn yields, but there is not a net benefit for the grain crops of increased CO2. Indeed, some CO2 is desirable. Without CO2 and other greenhouse gases, the Earth would be roughly 30 degrees centigrade colder than it is. However, that does not mean that more and more CO2 becomes more and more desirable. Yes, during the Cambrian period and up to about 65 million years ago, the Earth was a much warmer place and life thrived most of the time. But there was very little to no glaciation, and sea level was about 230 feet higher than now. What we are currently doing is heading the planet back to a period with no glaciation, with coastlines at a place where most current coastal cities will be far underwater. The only question of debate will be how long it is going to take us to get there, and is the rate of rising seas and other climate changes, one at which our current civilization can adapt to without coming apart at the seams. More direct to a core argument of the stadium analogy, there are many occasions in the world where something present at low concentrations has large impacts. We in the pulp and paper industry are very familiar with having our world turned upside down by dioxin compounds present in the parts per trillion or even parts per quadrillion range. Carbon dioxide is very active in the infrared region of the light spectrum and hence has a significant effect on holding heat. Methane is even more active in the IR, so has large heat retention as well, even though it is present at parts per billion levels as opposed to carbon dioxide at parts per million levels. The level of CO2 in the atmosphere was very stable up until about 1800, with the rise corresponding to the Industrial Revolution rather than the American Revolution, so there is no reason to wrap a link to the American Revolution into the discussion. Regarding the level of crowding or lack thereof of the human species on the planet, it is a matter of opinion. It's interesting that Jacksonville, Florida, the city in the United States with the largest area, was chosen for the calculation, presumably to maximize the calculated space per person. If San Francisco, a city with almost the same population as Jacksonville, had been chosen instead, the calculated available space per human would have decreased by a factor of 16. However, the square footage space required for a human being to occupy is a specious argument. The real question is the square footage of space required to support that human being in terms of food, energy, water, and of course the waste products that his or her existence The discussion ignores other negative impacts of global warming, including more intense tropical cyclones, extremes of rainfall, both flood and drought, the advance of tropical vector-borne diseases into more northerly latitudes, the rapid advancement of warmer climate zones into both higher elevations and higher latitudes, causing ecosystem disruption, as well as the previously mentioned ocean acidification and sea level rise. By the way, a personal poll of college educational professionals, human-driven climate change, also known as anthropogenic global warming. 1. Highly skeptical. 2. Somewhat skeptical. 3. Uncertain. 4. Somewhat believe. 5. Strongly believe. Must provide name and email to avoid multiple votes by the same person. However, scientific fact will be the ultimate arbitrator of this matter, as scientific reality does not care about opinion polls. Jim Thompson once said, January 3, 2011, in a NIP on Fitzgerald. And Jim returns to this column saying, I'll point out a response to a survey, as John proposed above, is not scientific. However, it could be interesting and have its own merits. If you choose to respond, please put Fitzgerald's survey response in the subject line so I can find it. And next we have this from Annette Wright. Mr. Thompson, thank you for your column and for not name-calling those of us who are climate change believers. Your guesstimate that 90% of your audience is still skeptical is both surprising and disappointing. I hope you are wrong that it is that high. There are two essential questions. 1. Do you believe that climate change is real and caused by humans? 2. Do you think we should try to do anything to mitigate it? Skepticism is healthy, but the data overwhelmingly support that climate change is real and is caused by humans. You made a great point about our environment that, quote, the question is what is left to do and what is the cost, measured by any metric, to accomplish what is left to do, end of quote. I appreciate and share your concern over government intervention, taxes, and creating an unequal competition advantage to different countries, and so forth. So far as what to do about it, I like the idea of a carbon fee and a 100% return per capita dividend, regardless of income, as proposed by Dr. James Hansen. I have shared my current perspective, but I am continually searching for what others I respect think about the subject, which is why I'm so intrigued to learn exactly what your audience actually thinks. Our industry is collectively a great group of intelligent people. Again, thank you for covering such an important topic. No matter which side you're on, there are likely serious consequences. Maybe I am deluded, but I like to think that our industry can be part of the solution, since, as you point out in your email signature, a working forest provides wildlife habitat and carbon storage, and so forth. We need to do a better job of spreading our message of sustainability. Best regards, Annette Smith Wright. And Jim Thompson signs off saying, thanks everyone, be safe, and we will talk next week. Nip Impressions is written by Jim Thompson and is copyright 2019, Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, USA. All rights reserved.